This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
We've just got a little bit of music in the background that'll calm down in a second.
Hello, James.
Hello.
And hello, Steph.
Hello.
And thanks to the women from Her Voice talking about women and disability and violence tonight, which was a really interesting discussion.
It was.
With one of our favourite guests. We share her, Ms. Karen Pickering, one of our favourite feminists. We have quite a few favourite feminists. Top 10.
Many of them. But tonight we're not talking about that, even though we could. We're going to, in fact, talk to Crispin Hulls, who we had on as a guest some time ago, who is the former editor of the Canberra Times and a veteran commentator on federal politics and currently a freelance columnist who writes regularly for Fairfax Media. And, of course, we'll be talking about the new Turnbull ministry. They had its first cabinet meeting today. Will Turnbull be a new type of PM, really a PM for the 21st century, as he keeps going on about today? Or is he just simply a wolf in sheep's clothing? We'll ask him that. Will we get new policy and directions on all the things that he claims that he believes in, like marriage equality, climate change, and so on? And Steph, you also interviewed somebody who will be coming on as a guest later tonight. Can you tell us about that?
I did indeed. I spoke with Anne Summers, the famous high-profile Australian feminist and journalist. She's currently running a conference in Sydney, which is to mark the 40-year anniversary of her book.
Damned Whores and God's Police,
which was a sellout event in Sydney. But she's also doing a conversation series with British Somali feminist Nimco Ali. So I was talking with Anne about that.
And did she talk to you at all about the fact that Facebook wouldn't let her run a Facebook page on damned whores and God's
police?
It had the word damned and whores in it.
I did hear that on the grapevine. She's not a big fan of Facebook right now.
No, I bet she's not. We're going to have quite an interesting discussion tonight, I think. And you can join this discussion, no joysters.
Please do. You can SMS on 0427 JOY949 or email onair@joy.org.au. Crispin Hull, who we're speaking to, is one of the top political commentators in the country. So he knows a lot about politics. He's your man.
He does. And you can ring
us a line.
You can ring Robbie out on the front desk. Hello, Robert, on the front desk. You can ring Robert on the front desk. He's got nothing to do. He's sitting out there drinking a cup of coffee. And he'd love to take your questions. He'll write them down. He'll run into the studio or email them into the studio to us, and we will ask them on air. So if you want to join this discussion, please do. We'd love to have you on.
1300 JOY 949. That's 1300 569 949.
I think Crispin might be there now. Are you there, Crispin?
Yes, indeed.
Hello.
Oh, we must have had a live radio issue there, I think. But anyway, and it's good that you're back with us, and welcome back to It's Nothing Sacred. It's good to talk to you. So we've been watching today and yesterday, since the Abbott dismissal, it doesn't really rate a dismissal, does it? It's not really
the spill.
It does in this respect, the reflections of Gough Whitlam, with Malcolm Turnbull, the similarities between Gough Whitlam's energy and optimism when he came into office and Turnbull's.
I watched Turnbull on the 7:30 report tonight. That was a bit interesting. Does that signal a new relationship between the ABC and the government?
Oh, yes, yes. He's a great media talent, Turnbull. You only have to ask him one question and the whole half hour is taken up.
Well, that was true tonight, that's for sure. Can I ask you, he goes on about how he's a PM for the 21st century and he's got a government for the 21st century. Is that hype?
Well, yes and no. He's got a bit of a task ahead of him in the next year to get through to the election and then get re-elected. And to do that, he's obviously put all of the social, press button issues that conservatives get agitated about to the back burner and saying, well
we've all noticed he's put a marriage equality to the back burner, which is a big issue for this radio station, of course.
Yeah. And
the Republic.
Other progressive things he's couched in economic terms, like, investment in science and research and so on, which Conservatives are very upset about, because, you know, that's science has always challenged, you know, dogmatic conservatism and
right. Evidence is always hard to deal with, isn't it, when you're
it is
when
indeed,
you're in that case.
It is. But Turnbull's, you know, put his faith in science and technology and couched in terms of economics, which the conservatives can understand. So he seems to me to be neutralising the conservatives for this next year. And if he wins the election, there's nothing like success, and then he can pursue, you know, the harder, more difficult social questions, which
like climate
hit
change,
the conservative, yeah, which hit the conservative buttons. Yeah.
And do wind farms cause bad health or not?
Well, on climate change, it's interesting. I think that under existing policy and law, Turnbull can make, you know, significant changes by cranking up direct action and investing in more in renewable energy under existing policy and law, without being accused of backflipping or whatever.
But direct action's a pretty hard one on economic grounds, isn't it? Because it's actually rewarding things that
that's true.
That the market would deal with normally.
That's true, and there is a contradiction there. But if you crank up the direct action high enough so that you don't reward emitters, then you can get some results.
The thing that really interests me, Crispin, is the Turnbull legacy of the National Broadband Network, because last week there was quite a lot of media in things like The Conversation and Crikey and so on about the blowout in costs and time and convenience of the new national broadband, the copper wire-based broadband system.
Well, Turnbull was given an impossible job.
Yeah, so it sure was, but he's now given it to a Turnbull loyalist, Senator Mitch Fifield, who is actually a Victorian senator. Is this something that is potentially going to undo the Turnbull prime ministership?
Not really within the parameters. He can change the policy. The thing was, Abbott was dead against NBN because it was public enterprise, and he didn't like it. He wanted to scrap the whole thing.
He wanted Goldman Sachs to own it, I suppose.
Yeah, and so he gave Turnbull this, you know, almost impossible job, and so Turnbull tried to downsize it and privatise it, and has ended up with a cost base exactly the same as the NBN, with a worse result. So that may come, you know, to bite him, but he can probably get around it.
So who are the big losers and why, and who are the big winners and why?
So who are the losers and who are the winners?
Yep. Well, Joe Hockey's clearly the big loser, isn't he?
Yeah, let's leave all the personalities aside on winners and losers and look at other things. The winners are rationality, science, evidence-based policy,
good,
women, moderation.
It
and
looks
that's probably more important than the personalities. On the personality front, probably the biggest personal, richly undeserved winner is Peter Dutton, who, after his horrible, snide comment about poor people who are going to lose their homes through rising sea levels, has retained his ministry. And the only reason is because Turnbull wants to neutralise conservatives and say, well, we're still stopping the boats, we've got a Queensland copper in charge.
So it seems like he's ticked a few boxes in terms of coming across as very rational, very friendly. There was those articles about how the shape of his face means that everyone's going to like him. Is this just going to be a surefire win for the election next year?
Well, if you look at the Canning by-election result, the parties are pretty even at the moment, very even, whereas before they weren't.
I mean, I think that isn't one of the really interesting things the sort of Xenophon type factor, because, you know, Nick Xenophon, who is a South Australian senator, is polling extremely well. He was under Abbott in South Australia so well that he might have actually wiped both the other parties off the electoral map there.
Oh, but could have got lower house seats, yes.
And he could have swept through the Senate ticket. But there's also the wonderful, as we call him here, Senator Corgi Bernardi.
Yes, you got the full range there in two people.
You sure do. And Senator Bernardi has taken off his Twitter handle, Liberal Senator for South Australia, and now got Conservative Senator for South Australia. And there's all this rumbling about, is he about to form the new right-wing party? And in fact, there was some serious discussion on the ABC yesterday about, is there going to be a right-wing party emerging because of the Turnbull Prime Ministership? What do you think about that?
Talk of new parties is...
Well, there's already three of them, aren't
there? And Cory Bernardi's got to think, you know, in South Australia, if he sets up a new party, he'd be lucky to get himself into the Senate, especially as, you know, one of the non-major party posts in the Senate is already taken by Xenophon. So, you know, it's all political suicide, really, isn't it?
Good.
Crispin, we do have to go to some messages, but please stay on the line and we'll be back shortly. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Hello, you are on Joy 94.9. You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred with Steph, Jim and James. And we are on the phone in Queensland to Crispin Hulls.
We're not on the phone in Queensland, but Crispin's on the phone in Queensland.
Yes.
We're all technically on the phone through the power of technology and radio. So we are talking to Crispin about the new Prime Minister, about his strategy, about whether he's going to win the election. And we are taking your questions too. Just SMS 0427 JOY 949 or email on air at joy.org.au.
There are a few, aren't there, conservatives like Peter Dutton who maintain their ministries. There's George Brandis who's supposedly a liberal but was fairly brutal in the arts. He retained Attorney General, but he lost the arts. Barnaby Joyce, of course, retained agriculture, but gained water. Peter Dutton stayed as Immigration Border Protection, and Susan Ley has stayed as the Health and Sports Minister.
And there's also been a change to the Defence Minister. Are we expecting to see a change in defence policy?
Oh, the defence is such an awesomely huge bureau.
No bonus submarines?
Well, Australia has long thought that, you know, Adelaide is the place that is the natural place for building submarines. But, you know, that was a confection of Kim Beazley in the 1980s. You know, Bomber Beazley, Toys for Boys, and he had the opportunity to say, well, let's build a Collins-class submarine down in South Australia and pick up some seats. South Australia is an idiotic place to build submarines. If we must have submarines, it's much better to build them in a place where there's an industrial base in Melbourne or Sydney. And, of course, with the submarines, we've been talking about, you know, should we build our own or should we get Japan to build the submarines? But we haven't asked the question, do we really need any submarines at all? Given the money...
Well, I'd agree, no, but I remember when I used to work in politics in Canberra for an Adelaide-based minister, the question of do we need submarines was always politically answered, not defence answered. But the interesting thing about Maurice Payne is that she's got a very broad cross-sectional base because she used to be, in her younger years, and she's got very good connections on the other side of politics, she used to be the Secretary of the AIDS Council of New South Wales for a while. So she's got very good Sydney, inner-city liberal type, and I mean liberal in the small L sense, Quals, but she's also been...
Low-key hard worker.
And been on the Defence Committee of the Parliament for years.
Yeah. I have to declare a conflict of interest here. Maurice Payne and my wife were mates in law school and known each other for a long time. So, but anyway, I think she'll do a terrific job in defence.
Crispin, getting back, as I said, away from personality onto perhaps more policy changes and what we may or may not see, I mean, I suppose the biggest one, what we haven't seen changes in some key areas, as we already know, will be a bit of a wait and see how much he can move the dinosaurs in his party forward. But I suppose the biggest one was the change of tone on clean energy and renewables. Do you see this perhaps more of a broader shift across science and technology, and perhaps trying to neutralise what a lot of the perhaps the Labor and the Greens lines have been on, more of a future economy or a more of a clean green image. Do you see that as a change in direction?
Well, it's a way that Turnbull can use to persuade his Conservative base to say that this is a major economic issue.
And he's put Christopher Pyne in there.
Yeah, unless Australia's right at the forefront in science and technology. Turnbull even pointed to the possibility that Australia cannot necessarily guarantee it's a first world country anymore unless we're up there with it. You know, we can wallow down. And he's quite right on that. You look at Argentina. Argentina, in 1905 was one of the top three countries in the world for per capita GDP, and look at it now. There's no guarantee that Australia stays in the top, 8 to 10 economies per capita in the world. I mean, we can go to hell in a handbasket very quickly, like Argentina did, unless we have the sort of spirit that Turnbull's talking about with innovation and technology.
Will we see the flow through of that? Will it be to universities or research centres, or do you think Turnbull has ideas about what kind of research investment he wants?
Well, I think he seems to be a bit of a keen supporter in pure science and recognises the sort of equations that Australia can get with, if we've got, say, the ANU in the top 20 universities contributing to world research, we get a big a dividend from that, because one or two of our universities or three or four of them are up in the top league, and they share this research base, and they're much more important than sharing intelligence. Is sharing, being in the top league of research, the dividends are enormous.
And hopefully that would then attract young researchers or successful researchers back to Australia, or keep them in Australia, because we've seen a migration overseas of scientists, so that would be exciting to keep them here.
Well, to keep some, but also keep sending them and having the interaction that's important. An equal interaction is what's important.
So, Crispin, putting our sceptical hat on, as we always should, there's been as much a positive, perhaps, direction that policy is potentially taking, and obviously a change of the ministry in the right direction in terms of more moderation. Being sceptical, though, I mean, I've seen a lot of articles out this week in other media outlets that perhaps we need to be cautious in some ways. In what ways do we need to be cautious with conservative?
To be sceptical, Turnbull's been welcomed, and the change has been welcomed, quite broadly. But when you look at it, Turnbull now sitting as Prime Minister is being compared with, nearly a decade of this, more than a decade of dysfunctional government, from about 2006 with the destabilisation of Howard. We've got a decade of, pretty crap government. So, of course, he's going to look like a pretty shining star just to be, moderately competent and reasonable and sensible.
Can I ask, do you think that it is really just a case of having a crap government, or do you think it's a case that society has changed since the Howard years in terms of things like the rise of social media, shifts in the way that people view authority figures that makes it a lot harder to govern and make people perhaps seem less shiny than they were back in Howard's day and before?
Government's always been difficult, and in the early years of Australian Federation, we swapped governments every 5 minutes between protectionists and free traders and the Labor Party. I don't think that changes. I think we've had that period of bad government because of bad personalities through that period who happened to get to leadership positions in their party.
Chris, but I'm really interested in pursuing what's going to happen in the crossbenches in the Senate and the rise of the new parties. So, there are already two new parties in the Parliament in terms of the Palmer United Party and the Katter Australia Party. The Greens hold more Senate seats than they've ever held. And do you think that Turnbull is going to be able to fight off that that development of a much more factionalised Senate and the potential rise of the smaller parties in the lower house, like the threat of Nick Xenophon in South Australia?
I don't have much evidence for this, but I think that in the agenda of the coalition government now, there's a little item which says reform Senate voting system. And I reckon that's gone from about 284 up to about number 5. And my guess is that Turnbull will reach across to the Labor Party on this and say we have to deal with it and get it through before the next election.
So would the intention be that by changing the model that it would have impacts for some of the smaller parties like the Greens?
No, to wipe out the micro parties.
Oh, micro parties.
Not the minor, so you've got major parties, minor parties and micro parties.
I think
the
most
micro parties are the last person left standing in any Senate race in any state. And they've gathered together, having just got a few votes, they've gathered together all of the preferences on the way.
And in fact, Mal Brough, who's the Special Minister of State and in charge of electoral reform, said tonight on the ABC that was one of the
small amount of evidence, yes.
Yes, one of the things that he was going to be concentrating on was how to stop the far right electing the far left. And the far left electing the far right.
And the public does.
I'm not sure who the far right and the far left in the Senate is. I can't think that it's Jackie Lambie and Ricky Muir, but anyway, I suppose they could be.
Well, there's it should be relatively simple, something like, you've got to have 3 or 4% of the first preference vote to stay in.
Which is what most electoral systems have, don't they?
Yes, I mean, all of those proportional systems, Germany and France and so on, unless you get a certain amount, you don't get any seats at all.
Mm. And presumably that's something that the Australian public would support, I assume.
Oh, yes, there shouldn't be any difficulty. All the other possibility is just to have preferential voting above the line, so that instead of you putting one Labor Party and then the Labor Party determines, one Liberal Party determines your vote right down to the end, you can go one Labor, 2 Greens, 3 Liberal, 4 Lunatic Party, 5 very lunatic party, and that's the way it falls. That would have been a far better way of doing it.
Yes, maybe not so good for the lunatic party. We're going to go to some messages again, so please stay on the line, and we'll be right back. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hello, you are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. We would love you to have your say. 0427 Joy949 or email on air at joy.org.au or phone 1300 Joy949. We are talking with Crispin Hull all about the new Prime Minister, about strategy, what's going to change, where we're going next, and we would love to hear from you.
Crispin, my question, I try and keep it as simple and concise. Probably, throughout the Abbott government, there's been, luckily, a lot of bad policy stopped in the Senate, but there's been a lot of things that have got through that are probably considered quite terrible for Australia's future. If you could name, opinion, maybe 2 or 3 of the most, the worst policies that got through in that time, that you do you see them perhaps being repealed or changed under Turnbull ministry or a prime minister, or is it, do you think it's going to stay put?
Let's look at good policies which didn't get through. Indexation of the fuel excise tax, which should have gone through. Bad policies which didn't. The university stuff could have been tweaked better, and the GP co-payment. Stuff that got through, which should not have got through, was changing to the mining tax, the changes to the mining tax and the carbon tax. I mean, how can a government say that there's an economic crisis here and then repeal sources of revenue? A sm- harder way to go. Obviously, Abbott had nailed his colours to the mast on this. Would have been to allow, in this instance, to allow the Senate crossbenchers to say, well, we're not going to let you repeal the carbon tax, we're not going to let you repeal the mining tax, and he can go to the electorate and say, well, look, I did my best, you know, and they just didn't allow me to
abolish. Mind you, he had the miners giving them a lot of money, didn't he, so he needed to be a bit protective of them.
Hello, you dropped out.
I said he had the miners giving him a lot of electoral donations, so he needed to be a little bit careful of them.
Where else are they going to go?
Very true.
Oh, I don't know, they could have gone to Gary Gray.
Yes, indeed. But it's amazing what a small amount of money will do. I mean, $22 million they threw at that campaign during the Gillard time to get the tax change, which is nothing to them. And the policy change is worth millions to them.
So, Crispin, you mentioned the mining tax and the carbon tax as two bad policy decisions in the Abbott government. Obviously, in your opinion, do you see any of those changing under our new Prime Minister?
I don't think he can bring back a blatant carbon tax. I think he can tweak the direct action in a way that almost comes around as an emissions trading scheme. By there's in the legislation there's provision to make big emitters pay big penalties, and the regulatory setup under the legislation at the moment is the big emitters don't have to pay much, but without changing the legislation you can crank up the regulations.
Is the price is it the price that's regulated?
Trading scheme. You know, it's amazing what you can do with regulation under existing legislation. And it's also amazing what you can do with legislation without changing the constitution.
That's interesting.
If you apply a skilled legal and administrative mind to it, well, you can almost get a republic without changing the constitution.
That's worth trying.
Have they got any of those skilled legal and political minds?
Sorry?
Have they got any of those legal and political, skilled legal and political minds?
I don't think they've got it in mind, but I can give you a good example. When Paul Keating was Prime Minister with the Greens in the Senate, he had majorities. He could have passed legislation which said a Prime Minister shall not put the name of a person for Governor-General to the Queen without getting that name approved by two-thirds majority of a joint sitting. Legislation. Easy.
Good idea.
Could have done it, but he just wanted to appoint his own Governor General. But, you know, if Keating had done that and then rang up William Dean and said, look, I'm putting your name forward, are you happy? There would have been a vote of two-thirds of the joint sitting in favour of William Dean. And Australia would have said, well, that's not too difficult. Next stage is, you know,
let's have a republic. And
very easy.
William Dean would easily have made a transition to president.
Yeah.
Kristen, we are nearly out of time, but I'm still curious about your comment previously about us having 10 years of bad governments. What do you think are some of the key learnings that Turnbull can learn, I suppose, from our previous three prime ministers?
Well,
of what not to do.
I think he's already learned them. One is to say, if we change policy, that is not a backflip and you can't nail me against the wall. That is sensible conduct which ordinary humans
engage in. It's called agile and nimble, isn't it? That's the words.
You know, if you say, well, at the moment, the best thing for my health and fitness is to go on a 10-kilometre run every day. You go on a 10-kilometre run, and after 30 runs, you need two new knee operations. Well, hello, you no longer go out on a 10-kilometre run. Now, that's the same for governments. You know, they've got a policy. They think it's going to work. At the time, it looks like the right thing to do. But it turns out, a little bit down the track, that, you know, it wasn't so good, so let's change it. And don't be scared of it. And I think he's learned that lesson. And the other lesson he's learned is not to listen to, you know, yapping media people who want a quick story saying, will you rule this in or rule this out? And so if you don't rule out a change to the GST immediately, it means that you're going to increase the GST and all the horses are scared and you lose a lot of votes.
Will you put your hand on the Bible?
And it is childish, and Turnbull's right to say it's childish. So I think he's learned those things. But anyway, on this show, you know, is nothing sacred. One of the sacred things, did you notice, has gone in the first cabinet meeting. Did you notice how few blue ties there were?
I know, and in fact, Turnbull was wearing a red tie on 7:30.
Controversial.
And Abbott never wore anything other than a blue tie in his whole prime ministership.
Yeah, what colour tie he's going to wear.
Next, he'll be wearing a green tie just to mess with the system even more. Thank you so much.
And the other, very quickly, the other sort of sacred thing in Australia is if you give farmers water, they'll be happy. Well, Turnbull gave them water and they're still not happy.
Oh, no.
The Nationals.
He's going to have an extra card up his sleeve.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how Barnaby Joyce deals with science, evidence and water.
Yes.
So that will be a discussion for another program.
Yes, thank you so much,
Crispin, for coming on again. We really enjoy having you on as a guest.
Right.
And we will be watching with bated breath what happens over the next month or two and see
Interesting times, as they say. Okay.
Interesting times.
That's right. Hopefully the chicken hutch won't fall down. So thank you.
Thank you so much, and hopefully we can talk to you again. We had very good feedback after you ran our show last time, so that's why we're very keen to have you on again as our political commentator. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi, I'm Lily Tomlin, and you are listening to Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Joy 94.9, as Lily Tomlin just said, and you've been listening to Is Nothing Sacred? And we were talking earlier to Crispin Hulls, from the ex-editor of the Canberra Times and a federal government commentator, who now is a columnist for the Fairfax Media. And Steph, we now have another guest, don't we?
Yes, we do. I had a chat with journalist Anne Summers, who is author of Damned Whores and God's Police. Now, 40 years on, she's doing a conference this week, but also she has a conversation series recently, or previously she's been in conversation with Julia Gillard.
I went to that. It was fantastic.
Which everybody loved. So her next guest in her conversation series is Nimco Ali, who is a British Somalian feminist and strong, probably one of the world leading campaigners against female genital mutilation in Britain, but internationally as well. So Anne will be speaking with Nimco in Sydney on Thursday evening at Sydney Uni, and also in Melbourne next Monday, 6:30 at Deakin Edge, and there are tickets available. So have a listen. So, Anne, what is it that first made you to decide to choose Nimco Ali for your next guest in your conversation series?
Last year, I was very lucky and was invited to take part in a Women of the World conference in London around International Women's Day, and I found myself sharing two different panels with Nimco, and that's when I first met her, and I was just absolutely blown away at how an incredible woman she is. I mean, she's got an incredible story to tell, because she's a British Somalian woman who at the age of seven, she's now 32, but at the age of seven she was taken back to Africa and underwent a shocking form of female genital mutilation. And once she left university and kind of decided to take this on as an issue, and she's taken it on in a way that's very kind of radical and very confronting, and she talks about, you know, the Fanny Defence League. She talks about, you know, she walks around carrying a sign, "Mitts off my muff," you know, so she doesn't kind of mince words when it comes to talking about, you know, what this issue is. It's basically, it's cutting women's, you know, clitorises off or sewing up their vaginas, and it's what she's managed to do it has been to redefine the issue of FGM away from being just a private community family matter to being seen as child abuse and as violence against women. And I thought that was a message that, you know, we really needed to hear in Australia, because, you know, FGM is also very prevalent here, But, you know, we still don't really like to talk about it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. To what extent do you know if this is happening in Australia, how many women or girls have been affected or might be affected here in Australia?
Well, I mean, I've been relying on, there's an NGO based in Melbourne called No FGM Oz, and run by Paula Ferrari, who's, you know, very energetic and very great campaigner on this issue. And she and the other people involved in the NGO have been compiling data, and what they have estimated is that there are around 83,000 women in Australia who have undergone FGM, and they are also estimating that there's around 6,000 girls who are currently at risk. And the two sort of things that can happen is that girls can be taken out of Australia by their families and taken to Indonesia or Malaysia or various African countries, you know, sort of back to the home country, and the operation is performed there. Or we're also finding out that there's quite a lot of backyard operators, certainly in Sydney, and I imagine the same is true in Melbourne, where these girls are taken to basically just private houses, and it's done there. And it's horrifying that this is being done in this country. And, of course, it's totally illegal, but we are not yet enforcing the laws strictly enough. And one of the things that NIMCO and the people she works with in the UK have been very successful in doing is getting the media to take it seriously and getting the politicians to take it seriously. And in particular, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, you know, who's a very conservative politician, but nevertheless, he has really spoken out very forcefully against FGM. And he has won, when I was in London last year for International Women's Day, as I mentioned, and the IWD speech that he gave included a strong commitment to ensure that people who were doing FGM in the UK were being prosecuted, and he's been good to his word, and there have been the first prosecutions in Britain over the past year.
Do you think that there are many Australians who know that this is happening? Because we don't hear many conversations, as you've said. Is that because people are not aware, or is it because they find it uncomfortable? What's the reason we haven't heard much about
this
until now?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and one that we certainly are going to be talking to NIMCO about in the conversation with her. And it's also something that I'm hoping, you know, the audience, I mean, I know there's going to be lots of people in the audience for the event in Melbourne on the 28th of September, who themselves are either, you know, FGM survivors or who are aware of what's happening in Australia and are working to stop it. And I think I really would like to hear from them as to what they think the reason is. I mean, there's no doubt that there's reticence in talking about it, and I don't know whether that's because it's to do with women's genitals or whether it's, you know, sort of cultural issues or what. I mean, I think that we have to confront that and work it out, because we do have to. I mean, I can remember some years ago when no one wanted to talk about domestic violence because that was just too hard, too confronting. We didn't want to know that, you know, women we knew were being, you know, having a shit belted out of them. And I think, you know, we now are facing up to that as a shocking problem, you know, of violence against women in this country. And I think we have to do the same thing with FGM.
And I guess the next thing I wanted to ask was about people who did have those cultural concerns, and I have heard some people say things along the lines of that we should let people practice their culture regardless of how violent it might seem from the outside. How would you respond to those comments?
Well, what I would say is, you know, listen to people like NIMCO Ali, who has, you know, who's Sudanese, and who listen to people like Kadaja Gabila, who lives in Adelaide and who is another FGM survivor who speaks out very, very strongly on this. And it's the women from those communities are the ones who have to say it. And I think people like me just, you know, have to back them up. But, you know, what they are saying is, you know, this is not a cultural practice that should be just condoned. This is violence against women, and this is child abuse. And I think it's very telling that the fight against FGM is being led by these young women who have themselves undergone it and who are saying, no, no, we are not going to accept, it's too late for them because it's already been done. But what NIMCO says is that she is determined that she will be the last person in her family to undergo FGM, and she's already claimed victory on that. She doesn't have children herself, but she has a four-year-old niece who's the light of her life, and she, you know, has saved her from FGM. And, you know, Nimco's from a family where she's the third generation, at least, to have undergone it.
Yeah, that's certainly a very powerful story. I also wanted to talk briefly about your conference, which is coming up, is it next week in Sydney?
It is. It starts on Monday, the 21st of September.
Very exciting. And I understand that sort of looking back 40 years as the anniversary of your book and then also looking forward. So I guess I'm curious to know how you're feeling about feminism at this point, what's happened over the last 40 years and what you'd be hoping to see in the next 40 years?
Well, I guess my very short answer is a lot has happened, but not enough. And there are certainly, many things that we can be very proud about. Australia has been transformed. We now have legal protections that simply didn't exist in 1975 when the book was published. And, you know, we've had opened up a lot of areas to women that previously we weren't able to, you know, to be included in. But I think despite all of those gains, you know, there is one of the things that I'll be arguing in my keynote speech at the conference is, you know, I don't think that we have really confronted our internal oppression nearly as much as we need to. And I'm not sure that we have overcome the two stereotypes, the things that I labelled damned whores and God's police. We still have ways of judging women and categorising women according to social norms that we think, you know, the way we should be organising society. And all too often, I think women themselves, you know, are enforcing these norms as well.
What are the things that give you hope that we can change?
Oh, one of the best things at the moment, I think, is that, you know, this incredible uprising by young women, you know, it really reminds me of the 1970s when a very similar thing was happening. And the women, you know, I was that age then, and I was certainly part of a movement that really set out to change the world. And you know, we did a lot.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
And there you are, Joysters. This has been Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and that was The Saints out of Brisbane with I'm Stranded, which is reputedly the first punk song ever in the world.
And a great doco that I watched that on, was it SBS or ABC?
It was on the ABC last week.
Oh, it was fantastic. All about punk rockers and
it had
what happened in Brizzy.
It didn't only have them, it had all the Brisbane bands, but it had the Go-Betweens, it had Nick Cave and the bands, Bad Season, Nick Cave and the Birthday Party. It had Bob Geldof and the Ramones and people like that all talking about the role of Queensland and the oppressive government.
I was going to say that perhaps the only good outcome of extreme conservative rule under Joe Peterson.
Wonderful music.
Yeah.
It's still a really good song. I love it. But anyway, thank you to our guest, Crispin Hull from who's a political commentator, ex-editor of the Canberra Times, and to Anne Summers, who talked to us about her conversation series on this time that's coming up.
Time next week, you can still get tickets. Just look online, Anne Summers, Nimco Ali. We'll also post on our Facebook page.
And it's down at Deakin Edge.
It is Deakin Edge. Be there.
At
Fed Square. And thanks, everyone, and have a really good night. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.